This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of America's best-known leftist journalists have English accents. One of them is my guest, Christopher Hitchens. He's a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's. His new book, Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, examines ironies in the relationship between England and America, culturally and politically. Hitchens told me what got him started on the subject.
Well, though I'd been in the United States for about 10 years, I had only just arrived about 10 years ago when began to notice, as you have to, the sort of amazing deference that was paid to Englishness in America, the way that the British seemed to exist in the American imagination. And this was in, you know, small things like being told by AT&T operators that they liked my accent, to the amazing cult of the royal family in the glossy magazines, the British royal family, to things like Masterpiece Theatre, where, you know, everywhere else in the world, everyone wants to watch American TV, and in America, the educated classes at least, like to watch what they thought of as quality British programming. And I thought there was a clue in that. All that was all to do with things about class and society and empire and so forth. These seem to be, in fact, to be the recurring themes. So that's why my book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia.
I'm interested in what else people responded to and still respond to in you as an Englishman.
Well, I think often they're kind enough not to say. but I do get... I actually remember when I very first came to the United States, I was getting on a bus at JFK and a guy overheard me asking directions and came up and said, "We all like Masterpiece Theatre." And I remember thinking, I don't know what he means by that. He obviously thought that this was a good way of recognizing my Englishness. I now do know exactly what he meant. I noticed also that one would get asked questions on airplanes by people. After shouting for a drink, they'd recognize I was British and would say, "Well, what about Princess Diana?" And so on. It generally tended to be that they liked the things about England that I had come to America to get away from.
Such as?
Such as monarchy, such as the vestiges of the empire, such as the way that you can tell anyone's social background by the way they speak as soon as they open their mouth. We call it being branded on the tongue in England. And then, you know, you didn't have to hang around very long in Washington to notice that there was a certain kind of iconography of people like Winston Churchill, sometimes Gladstone and Disraeli, but most often Churchill, when heroic speech was required by a president, usually calling on some policy of folly to be followed by the Congress or the press, they would always invoke analogies based on Churchill, Munich, Dunkirk, and so forth. I thought they've got, you know, a glorious history of their own in this country, a particularly good one, beginning, in fact, with the expulsion of the British monarchy from the national territory. Why do they never call on that? Then one day I was watching Oliver North being questioned by the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and a row broke out between two American legislators, both from California. This is in my book. One quoting Kipling and the other quoting Shakespeare, both about destiny and history and the military and so forth. And I thought, this is really weird. There is a book in here somewhere about the ghost of England that exists in the American body. And that's really what I've tried chapter by chapter to do an anatomy of.
So when Americans respond to Masterpiece Theater or admire you for your accent, what do you think they're secretly responding to?
Well, I think, see, the fact is that there are the various words in America that can't be used with ease, that can be used in England with ease. We say the word empire unaffectedly. We never said we didn't have one. The United States does have an empire and says it doesn't. The same with class. Officially, there is no class system in the United States. In fact, the fact that there is not admitted to be one is one of the reasons it's allowed, I think, to go on. Now, in this country, people say you've got class to mean all kinds of things. You've got style, you've got moxie, you've got this, all got that. But it's an interesting choice of term, don't you think, that they would say class was the thing you wanted. And they're borrowing at second hand, therefore, something that comes to them from an ancestral and traditional. I think probably the key word here is tradition. It's the yearning for a tradition in literature, in history, to some extent in politics. And borrowing it without quite realizing what they're getting, that they're getting a rather kitsch version of Englishness and having it recycled through the American system.
Do you think it's very unusual for a country that broke away from a country through a revolution to then want to emulate the country in so much of its culture?
It's, I think, entirely unprecedented, except perhaps in some bits of French-speaking Africa, where, you know, the school lessons used to begin with young African children chanting that their Gallic ancestors had blonde hair and blue eyes because they'd been taught that by the French, and so forth, and the impressions that left With this difference that, of course, now Britain is in effect a colony of the United States. I mean, certainly there's no precedent in history for the former colonial dependency becoming the actual imperial power. The only near analogy you can come to is one that the British establishment really love, and I have a chapter about this, that they think that Britain's new role in the world is to be Greece to the American Rome. That's to say, the older, exhausted, played out, but still in some way sophisticated culture lends a bit of tone and depth and style to the new, brash, vulgar, modern, enormous empire. And that was a self-consciously articulated position of a lot of British politicians starting in the Second World War, when they realized, look, the game's up. You know, we've managed to get America into Europe on our side now twice. They've saved the British bacon, but the price of this is going to be we will not be equals with them. We'll be the junior partner from now on.
Well, what way do you think England has become the junior partner or a colony of the United States?
Well, I give three examples in the book. One is, for instance, British nuclear technology was the first in the world to be developed for weaponry, and it was an enormous asset to the British in bargaining for American support in the Second World War. But within 4 or 5 years, the United States had got the secret for itself, had vastly outstripped the British, who then found, you know, they were having to petition with the Americans for simple sharing of information on nuclear questions. So that was a very, very quick example of, you know, the borrowing from the British of a scheme, a grand idea, converting it in effect for use against them. In a different way, you could say that the whole mythology of the spy world, which is very important in American fiction, in American movies, in American culture, the CIA, the OSS, and the rest of it, was completely invented on the British model, with British advice and British help, again, as part of our grand project, always, to involve America in war on our side. But after a bit, you know, the CIA and the rest of it became so much more important and commanding that Britain became a junior partner in that respect, too, though still thinking it did things slightly better and with a bit more panache and skill and sophistication, nonetheless conceding the main point of power. I said I'd give three examples. I've now forgotten what the third one is. Those are the sorts of things I write about it, at any rate.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Christopher Hitchens, and he's a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's. His new book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. You're saying that American Anglophiles are really expressing a very conservative impulse. On the other hand, I think you've left out a really important part of the English influence on America, and that's the Beatles, the whole British invasion of the 1960s. And I think for anybody who was growing up then, I mean, if you were copying a British accent, it wasn't because you wanted to be a duke or the prince or the queen. It's because you wanted to be John Lennon. Do you know what I mean? And
yes, I do know what you mean, certainly, and I've wrestled with it a bit in the book. People were not copying Liverpool accents any more than they were copying, you know, South London or suburban accents with the admiration for Mick Jagger. It's true there was a time when Britain represented itself as being finally classless in the early 60s, and that made it probably easier for its popular culture to be exported. But that's now no longer the case. I mean, by the time I got here, certainly, the thing that all Americans were absorbing most eagerly from Britain was Brideshead Revisited.
Well, since the Beatles aren't mentioned in your index, I was wondering if you're kind of overlooking of the British invasion.
I think you'll find Liverpool. I think you'll find Liverpool. Is it? Look under L.
Okay. But I was wondering if this was perhaps a reflection of your class.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, yes, of course it is. Everything about me is, as is true of anyone born in my country. However long we stay away, you know, you don't escape that kind of upbringing. But I do notice in the book, I do mention the Beatles under Liverpool. I do also mention that skinhead and punk are two things that have been emulated from Britain while I've been in the United States. Now, both of those were authentic expressions of a British proletarian, in one case, semi-fascism, I'm speaking of the skinheads, and in the other case, of a sort of slightly neurotic despair about unemployment and the blank generation, as they call themselves. But, well, when they were taken up here, they were as points of style. You know, they were things to emulate. They were fashion statements. In Britain, they actually were genuine features of the social scene and comments on the social fabric. So that, in other words, I mean, you may think I'm trying to have it both ways, but it seems that as long as it was British, it was in some way automatically intelligible, even if it didn't fit the usual diagram of the country house, the red uniform, the Khyber Pass, the you know the rest of it, the upstairs-downstairs fantasy.
Okay, we left off wondering where the Beatles and punk music fit into your view of how English culture has influenced American culture. And I asked you if you thought this was related to your class or not. So what is your class? Were you at what strata were you born?
Well, a great deal of trouble is spent on giving a confusing answer or being able to give a confusing answer to that question. As it happens, I mean, I'm a Navy brat. My father came from a rather poor area of Portsmouth, which is a Navy town where most of my male ancestors come from. And due to the exigencies of war and so forth, by the time I was born, he was an officer. In other words, he'd moved up a class through the sort of turmoil of the mid-20th century. And what you do in England if you move up a class is you send the proof of it, the certificate of it, is you send your firstborn son, that's me in this case, to private school. I was the first Hitchens to be privately educated. We call them public schools just to keep you guessing.
Right.
Also the first one to go to university, in my case, Oxford. But I'm the first one in my family to, if you like, sound like this. And you were made to feel it very much that you were, in that sense, upwardly mobile. I'm always a bit embarrassed to talk about my biography in this way. I don't know quite how it fits me to talk on this subject. An interesting fact about it, though, is that at the level of society in which I was brought up, there was very, very, very strong lower middle class anti-Americanism of a conservative kind, a sort that's dying out now. People thinking basically that the United States had cheated Britain out of the empire, had let Britain bleed during the war, and had picked up, you know, the colonies as part of the price of stepping in belatedly. This was part of the mythology of a resentful, declining country. And I think that probably had quite an influence on me when I came to write on these subjects later.
You are really one of the more visible leftist journalists in the United States, with regular appearances both in The Nation and Harper's Magazine, as well as writing books and writing for other places. I'm wondering if you think that your British accent helped you in your career in America. You know, even though you're British and are writing for American papers, you've done very well. Do you think that the British accent helps make your leftist views more palatable to those Americans who don't think of themselves as leftists?
Well, I've certainly tried not to be a professional Englishman, as some journalists who've come here, I won't mention any names, but I'm sure they're well known to the sort of people who listen to National Public Radio. You know who they are.
And I won't ask you what sort you mean by that catty comment.
I don't want to be a professional Brit, and when I write, I don't write in an English accent.
Uh-huh.
So people, though, I think, some people claim to be able to guess. Occasionally it comes up that when it's, no, I mean, it hasn't. Nor has it been what I thought it might be, which is a disadvantage. That's to say, I've been very impressed that, you know, I've often been on radio shows and debated with prominent conservatives and told them where I think they're wrong and why their President Reagan is no good and so forth, and now their President Bush. And only on, I think, one occasion did anyone ever say anything like, well, if that's how you feel, why don't you go home, sort
right.
of attitude. Very, very, very rare. Also reflected in the mailbag I get and the phone calls. An incredibly generous and courteous attitude of the sort that we're supposed to. I mean, we, the British, are well known actually to be the rudest people in the world. We're supposed to exemplify the kind of politeness you actually only find in the United States. So, no, I think not. There is the advantage it's given me, I think, and the advantage given in writing this book is that I was brought up in a country that was beginning to get used to the idea of no longer being a superpower, but was doing so reluctantly and very painfully. By superpower, I really mean, obviously, not any longer being an empire. And that has been a help to me in analysing America, I think, because you hear occasional politicians saying, well, if we don't stop them in fill-in, wherever the blank may be, Grenada, Beirut, Saigon, you know, Salvador, they'll be at the borders in no time and so forth, and civilization will come to an end. And I thought, yeah, I've heard all that before. I heard that when I was 8 from, you know, ridiculous Tories saying we should be governing Egypt. So it made it easier to be unimpressed.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's made me sad because there are lots of things about Britain that I do admire, I want to say, that never do get praised here, or not praised enough, and don't get borrowed. We have, for example, still, despite Thatcher, a very good national health provision. We also have quite a good parliamentary system where, you know, the Prime Minister just has to come twice every week and really get it from the legislators without notes and without advisers and without handlers. And face it, it would be wonderful if the United States would borrow things like that. Instead, what you tend to borrow is monarchic ideas for your presidency. and sort of social Darwinist ideas from Thatcher. And this is a pity, it seems to me, because both countries have a great deal to teach one another. In Britain, I always argue that we should have an American constitution. We should have your Bill of Rights instead of our unwritten conservative compromise, which we don't even dare call a constitution. So this is why I'm trying to tease out in this sort of mid-Atlantic way in the book why it is that all the borrowings tend to be reinforcements of conservatism. I think that's an intriguing subject to pursue.
I think the American and British identity is being changed by new waves of immigrants.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you could compare how you think both countries are reacting to the new immigrants that are living in their countries.
Yeah, this is real history. I mean, and again, I have a chapter on this. It was very noticeable when the campaign against immigration first began in the United States in the 1890s. It was very, very specifically stated that the intention of opposing immigration in the United States was to preserve the Anglo-Saxon and Protestant character of the establishment. It was very specifically anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, and so forth. And people then didn't pretend they were talking about anything else. And that's where we get the idea of the WASP from. In Britain, of course, that's always said very fairly explicitly, too. It's a matter of preserving the character of the country against these hideous outsiders. The difference is Britain wasn't built by immigrants in quite the same way as your country has been, so that it's always harder in America to be anti-immigrant per se, unless you are an explicit racist, which of course some people are. And of course the United States is very big and has lots of room, and Britain is rather small. In both cases, though, the axiomatic assumption that the country is white and in some sense Christian, and by Christian they tend to mean Protestant, is being challenged, yes, demographically.
Christopher Hitchens is my guest, and he's a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. His new book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. I'm going to change the subject for a moment. I'm wondering how you think the American left has dealt with the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, and if you think that journalists or writers or just people active in the American left have felt any impulse to defend communism as it's fallen.
I found that the admission by the Soviets and their former allies that their system was almost a perfect failure, that it really didn't work in any way at all, didn't even work as a military and police system, let alone as an economy or a society, actually come to most people as an enormous relief. I mean, I can think of one or two people who have a faint nostalgia for the, as it were, the old motherland of the October Revolution. But generally speaking, no, people are very, very glad of the emancipation that's come and hope that it translates into an emancipation of American politics from this stupid Manichean search for communist malevolence behind any movement for reform or amelioration. And that would certainly be my position.
Have you been to Eastern Europe recently?
Yes, I was in Romania and Hungary over Christmas. I was in Romania on the first day of the post-Ceausescu epoch, in fact, and I'd come there from Budapest. And not long before that, had been in Czechoslovakia, where actually I was briefly arrested and deported for attending a Charter 77 meeting, where the intention had been to bring together all the Eastern European dissident movements and all the Western European and American disarmament movements and discuss the relationship between human rights and détente and denuclearization, which, of course, has always been the crucial relationship.
How were you asked to leave Czechoslovakia?
Well, I wasn't asked, I was told.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they locked us up for a bit and then threw us out and told us not to come back. I'm very proud, in fact, of the deportation stamp in my passport. I'm hoping to use it to cash in when I go back there. Certainly people I used to know then whose names couldn't be mentioned in the press are now things like ministers and professors and so forth. And it is one of the great pleasures in life to go back to a country you knew when it was once a dictatorship, when it's been emancipated. There's no feeling quite like it. It makes participation in politics worthwhile.
Is this the first time you've experienced that?
No, it's not. In Spain and in Portugal and in Greece, which were the three NATO free world dictatorships in Europe supported by the United States, I've had that experience in all three. I hope to have it in Turkey before long, though that seems to be a very stubborn case. I hope to have it in Chile. I had it in Zimbabwe, formerly Southern Rhodesia. I'd hope to have it in South Africa. Let's see, where else have I had it? Prompt me. There is another one. It'll come back to me. Oh, Argentina. Anyway, yeah, it's and I think also when I go back to South Korea, with any luck, I might be able to say that it certainly can't be any worse than it was when I went with Kim Dae-jung, the opposition leader, the day after Elliot Abrams, human rights spokesman for the Reagan administration, had said that if anyone killed him, it would obviously be the communists, and thus had licensed in advance any further attempts on his life by the regime, which had in fact been trying to kill him.
If I'm not mistaken, you have a brother who's also a journalist, but is much more conservative?
Yes, how do you know that? Yes, I do. Yeah, I've got a brother who's a very distinguished Fleet Street journalist. He's defense and diplomatic correspondent for a paper called the Daily Express. He's actually moving, I believe he's moving to Moscow soon.
Which one of you is the one that doesn't fit in with the rest of the family?
I suppose that would have to be me. But actually, in making our living this way at all, neither of us do, in that, you know, all the other Hitchenses back into history have, in a sense, been naval or military, so we're just scribblers. But he, for some reason, really admires our Prime Minister and went, in fact, as far as admiring your last president. So we had lots to talk about when we used to meet, but usually only at summits.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Christopher Hitchens' new book is Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.